Morning. Well, I've been gone for a couple of weeks, and I come back, and it's spring in California, only it's Minnesota. What's happening to our world? It's wonderful, I think, but I'm not sure. Today it's wonderful. So I'm going to continue where I left off last time, talking about the long poem. Didn't seem that long when I started it, but the long poem, Faith, Heart, Mind, Inscription, written by Sungson, around 600. So in your program, the lines I'm going to talk about today should be there. Consider motion in stillness and stillness in motion. Both movement and stillness disappear. There's a phenomenon that's been taking place in two or three, or maybe more, a few universities around the country the last few years, which really is based on Buddhist principles, Buddhist teaching. And it's generally called positive psychology. It doesn't seem to necessarily mean very much, but when I started reading about it, and of course it's been a long, long time since I was in college, but when I started reading about it, I saw, oh, this is all Buddhist stuff. Only they don't mention Buddhism. it comes originally from the work of a fellow named actually, he was a secondary person to promote it. Seligman, S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N, and his 15 years ago, his studies and his work on flow. So here we have, consider motion and stillness, and stillness and motion. Motion and stillness disappear. And Seligman talks about easy pleasures and deep happiness. Deep happiness for us in Buddhism is sukha. Sukha, deep joy, deep happiness in Sanskrit, sukha. We start with dukkha, with dissatisfaction, and we go right through it and find deep happiness. So, but Seligman starts with the easy pleasures. And the easy pleasures are maybe your favorite chocolate bar. At just the right moment when you really need it. Or maybe some kind of wonderful sexual experience that you weren't anticipating, that just occurred. the easy pleasures are sort of a pre-flow experience. or full-flow, F-A-U-X, flow. But not to demean them, not to demean them. When I was on vacation this last 2 weeks, we went to this place, hiked up to this place, the source. It's called the source. Well, really, it's the source of drinking water for this island we're on. So we're hiking to the source, and then we keep coming to these places we call the faux source. Because it looks like it should be the source. My God, where's the real source? Anyway, so these easy pleasures are fine. But real flow has seven components to it, which again come from Buddhist thought. Challenging, requiring skill, challenging. A clear goal, sense of control, concentration. Deep effortless involvement, and the sense of self vanishes, and time stops. And with the great artists in the world, we know about Bach at the organ. We know about Monet in his gardens. That's really, really flow. And in positive psychology, as in Zen, we say that flow can become something normative for us. It doesn't have to be just some artistic experience that happens rarely when we listen to a Bach sonata or we but it can become normative. So in these positive psychology courses, evidently, according to what I was reading, because as I say, it's been a while since I was even saw a college class, they do a couple things, which are Buddhist things, to cultivate flow. One is they try to expand positive emotion. Because just as in Buddhism, we start by saying that we need to come back to a sense of interdependence, the first step on the path, and then cultivate the good feeling that comes from that interdependence through our intention, whether it be kindness, whether it be love, whether it be responsible participation in society, all that will evoke positive emotions. And psychologists who are flow proponents have done studies in which they had people watch happy-making movies and then look at patterns, and then people not watch any movies and look at patterns. Well, the people who had watched the happy-making movies were able to see the larger pattern, the triangles within the square. But the people who hadn't watched the happy-making movies didn't see the triangles within the square. because when our emotions are positive, we're more receptive, we're more open. So in Buddhist practice, we come back and back and back to cultivating positive emotion. Through whatever we can do, through friends, through repeating things to ourselves, through our Zazen practice, we do that. And then we practice the paramitas. Those are things we practice to evoke positive emotion. We practice generosity. When you really are generous, it evokes positive emotion. We practice ethical behavior. We practice patience. We practice effort. We practice meditation. And we practice acting wisely. And all those evoke, if we do them sincerely, positive emotion. Not always, but they begin to create more of a context so that we can see the broader picture, so that we can be susceptible, open to flow. And another thing that Seligman talks about is finding your signature strengths and building on your signature strengths. A time when you experience maybe not quite flow, but what was the activity that you were in? Maybe a moment of flow. And repeating that activity, doing that activity again. Discover what your signature strengths are so you can build on those. Told my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, I think one of his signature strengths was that working with rocks, or you could say playing with rocks, I don't know. But from the time he was a very young man, after he would do Zazen in the morning, he would go out and be with rocks, working with rocks, working on his rock garden, putting together, building walls, creating little rivulets of streams. And by the time I knew him, he had been doing this for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years. So this was definitely a signature strength for him. And everybody wanted to, when we got signed to jobs at Tassajara, everybody wanted to work on rocks with Suzuki. Because we got kind of a contact high by being in his flow with the rocks, right? Which is not his flow. It's the flow of all life. But that was one of his signature strengths. So we too discover our signature strengths and build on them. Signature strength of mine has been hiking in nature, because my parents started taking me hiking in nature in the mountains in the Sierras when I was like 8 years old, and I had a few experiences which were just wonderful. Now, did they fit all these seven of these criteria? Well, I don't know. I didn't know then, and I don't know now. But they encouraged me. And when I began Zen practice, and I had to sit in these horrible sesshins. Sorry, but they seemed horrible in San Francisco. When there was a break, I would rush out to the park. And there was a little hills in the park, and I could, oh, finally. I have some experience of flow, not in the session itself, but during the break. So if some of you don't know what I'm talking about, some of you really know what I'm talking about. So that's positive psychology, as some people seem to teach it, according to what I have read. I don't know if it's taught in Minnesota or not. Is it? Oh yeah, in a therapist's office, sure, sure. and of course, in Zen, we're going beyond that. Once we've developed some signature strengths, we're moving out into the world and seeing how much we can open up in contexts that are our signature strengths. How much we can concentrate and evolve to kind of an effortlessness where the sense of self vanishes and time is no longer an issue. How much we can do that. Again, for me, sweeping. I grew up in a house where nobody wanted to do the chores, and my father made us do the manual labor. He made us do so much a week, so it had very negative ramifications for me. Then I began hanging out with my teachers, and after meditation, we swept. Everybody swept. So at first, what seemed pretty negative began to be an extension of my zazen, just naturally. And I guess it was flow, although I never thought about it this time. I know that it was fun, and it still is fun to sweep. Just to give myself to it. And then, of course, if we're pretty sincere Zen students, we go on to the things that are really difficult for us, and whatever they are, we just do them. In retreat and daily life, we just do them with the same sense that we bring to any of our activities, even if they're really hard. And sometimes there's no flow at all. When I first made my big robe that I wear, or actually when I first made my first rakusu, which was a black one, this is a rakusu, it was awful. It seemed stupid. It was painful. And the sewing teacher kept making me rip everything out that I had done. Boy, what is that? Positive psychology? Rip it out. Do it again. No flow there. But, you know, I kept doing it. You know, there's a historical significance to it. It has some meaning to it. I got through the first one with a lot of help from my friends and people who didn't seem like my friends, but they really were. And then I had to do a big black robe, and that was like, what does that take, 100 times harder? I had never darned a sock in my life. And then, many years later, I had to sew a big brown one, which is the, I think, the last sewing robe, but maybe there's something I don't know about. There's always something we don't know about, you know. Whenever we think it's last, it's not last. Then we're clinging to something. But by that time, it was kind of wonderful. And not the whole time, but much of the time, I was concentrated. I had a sense of my goal. It was pretty effortless. And there wasn't a lot of chattering or complaining. And I had to rip a lot of things out, but geez, I didn't mind. It seemed like it was just what we were doing. And of course, I got a lot of help from my friends, and even by that time, I thought even but the strict people were my friends. took me a long time to realize that. A long, long time. So, consider motion and stillness, and stillness and motion. Both movement and stillness disappear. And the second line, when such duality cease to be, oneness itself cannot exist. So, flow is just a word. Zen is just a word. An algebraic sign for something. What is an algebraic sign for? For something. Something unnameable. Something unexplicable. Something that breathes through words and silence, through our pores, through difficult times, through easy times. But it's just an algebraic sign, so there's no need to create a religion out of flow, or even out of Zen. The minute we create this little religion, then we've lost our openness. That's why some of my favorite Zen teachers talk about Zen being the religion of no religion. And yet, we're in the world. We're open, and we're still a lot of the time. We have a lot of difficulties, and we just deal with them. When such dualities cease to be, oneness itself cannot exist. Things are ultimately, finally, subject to no law. So, there's no law of flow to cling to, there's no law of Zen, no law of interdependence. Interdependence is fine, but as soon as we get attached to it, then that attachment creates some kind of a problem for us. And we don't measure up. And when we don't measure up, then interdependence is an artifice that we've created. It's not real interdependence, it's genuine. Things are ultimately, finally, subject to no law. No law. Things just are what they are. Everything is what it is. Period. No comma. Period. Things are ultimately, finally, subject to no law. For the unified mind, in accord with the way, individual activity ceases. So individual activity ceases. As I've said a few times, the listener is the listened to. The seer is the seen. Even the thinker is the thought. And this is what we discover in our Zen, in our practice, in our life. We discover this. But it seems kind of hard sometimes. You may say, oh, I get a glimpse of this, but then it's gone. Then I'm entangled again in all that same shit. Excuse me. I'm entangled again. Here I am, back again. But the simple teaching is the seer is the seen. The hearer is the heard. That's it. That's it. But that may create some doubt for you. For me, it always created doubt. Oh, that's some... Yeah, I used to say, well, sure, that might be for you, true for you, Suzuki, but not for me. For you, Katagiri, but not for me. It creates some doubt. It should create doubt. If you just go around mouthing it, I don't think it's really going to penetrate. I don't think it's going to be really the inscription of the heart mind. So that doubt that comes up in spiritual practice, in Zen practice, in Buddhist practice, that is doubt sometimes in everything. Sometimes a doubt in yourself, doubt in the teacher, doubt in Zazen, doubt in all of this talk about flow and not flow, talk about effort. Doubt. And Hakuin, what does Hakuin say about doubt? He says, good. He talks about the great doubt. The great doubt. Because if we doubt, we're more open. We're taking this more seriously. It's not just something that we're doing as an exercise. And it does seem kind of impossible sometimes. Kind of impossible. So doubt will be with us. Doubt will be with us. But if we continue with the practice and we build on our signature strengths, we work with our emotions, our unwholesome dharmas, for those of you who've been studying with me, to our wholesome dharmas, this just means unwholesome emotions to wholesome emotions, that's all it means. We work with them. We work with the paramitas, which the ones, the six ones that I was talking about, including generosity, ethics, patience, meditation, effort, wisdom. If we work with those right in the middle of our doubt, then there is some faith there. But the faith isn't faith in something. It means that we're continuing with our difficulty in our zazen, continuing with our working with ourselves, even in a real difficulty. And that's faith. That means that the heart mind already is inscribed a little bit into our skin. Already we have a little tattoo in our skin of the heart mind, an indelible tattoo. Because we continue. We continue. Good times or bad times, in between times. So that's why faith, heart, mind, inscription is not faith in heart, mind. It's the inscription that takes place through giving yourself to this life that you have. Whatever this life is, just giving yourself to it. Just being with it. And retreats are a time that we, in Zen, but also in all the contemplative religions, all the contemplative orders of all the religions of the world, retreats are important. It doesn't matter whether, from my point of view, whether it's a Zen retreat or not. Times when you retreat, it's times when you're just still, when you don't have distractions, when you're just with yourself so that you can have an opportunity to inscribe this heart mind into your being. You have an opportunity to be with the doubt that comes up in a retreat, in any kind of retreat. Doubt may come up at any time. And you have nothing to hang on to except just being with it, just inscribing, just staying with it, staying with the process. For the unified mind, in accord with the way, individual activity ceases. All doubts are cleared up. Truth, faith is confirmed. So this just means that we inscribe this practice into our, not just our skin, but our flesh, bones, and marrow. That's all. No big deal, right? Just inscribe it. I know it hurts, but the inscription opens you up. Huge opens you up. Huge. You can't have sukha without dukkha. You can't have deep joy without being with your dissatisfaction, whatever it is, with openness, with tenderness, sometimes with complaining, but then just see the complaining. All doubts are cleared up. Truth, faith is confirmed. Nothing remains behind. There's not anything we must remember. Nothing remains behind. There's not anything we must remember. Since for about the last 5 years, people have been dying on me. Because since my late 50s, people have been dying. The older generation, my mentors, Zen, relatives, people I respected, people I loved, they're dying on me. This will happen to you too, probably. I think it's bound to happen to you too. And this is very sad. I feel very sad to have these people die on me. Of course, I'm being a little facetious, Sam, when I say dying on me. But
they're leaving. They're leaving.
But still, nothing remains behind. Nothing remains behind. Because the things they told me, the love they gave me, the wise things they did, even if they were just little wise things, if I was open, if I was inscribing, allowing to be inscribed that their love in me, it's here. It's here. So nothing remains behind. Nothing remains behind. Even though I still cry when I miss them, still they're more alive. My teacher, my first teacher, is more alive than ever now. So the inscription gets deeper. The people who loved and cared about you and shared with you are more present than ever, whether they're in their bodies or not. Whose body? What body? This is the body of the universe, right? Big body. Big body. All we need to do is inscribe. Nothing remains behind. There's not anything we must remember. We don't need to remember anything. Just keep inscribing. And we keep falling down. We maybe want to quit inscribing, but even if you don't do Zen practice anymore, if you're sincere in your life, you're inscribing. So whether you're in a Zendo or not, I won't say it's entirely irrelevant. If I say that, none of you would ever come sit with me. And I'd be sitting all by myself crying. Nothing remains behind. There's not anything we must remember. We don't have to remember anything. I just spent 2 weeks with my grandson who's 17 months old. And he's just standing up and taking his first steps. Standing up and taking his first steps. One step, two steps. He did 7 steps. Well, the most he did. Well, in 2 weeks, right? 7. They're all counting. Because he's the first grandchild, so, you know. Maybe you don't know how. Well, maybe you remember. And he's always falling down, right? But he doesn't remember, luckily. If he remembered all the times he fell down, he would just be a four-legged for his whole life. But he doesn't remember. He gets up again. And what we do, it's me and my wife and my daughter, who is his mother, and whoever else is around, when Ethan gets up, we cheer, yay! And then he takes a step and we cheer. He looks around, you know, and he falls down, right? Then we start cheering when he just sort of makes a little, and he gets up, and he falls down. Well, nothing remains behind. There's not anything we must remember, Barrett. That's how we've learned how to walk. That's how we learn how to live. We don't learn how to live by carrying around all this junk. That's all this junk we think we need to remember. You don't need to remember it. When it comes up, fine. When it comes up, fine. But your past difficulties, your past burdens, your burdens right now, you don't need to just go over and over them. You just don't need to. And you'll fall down plenty. You'll fall down plenty. But if you get up, after a while you'll be able to walk. And sometime you'll discover that flow is kind of just happening. The doubt is just coming in and you're not getting so freaked out that you're running to the Golden Gate Bridge. Excuse me, I'm from San Francisco, so you're running to the Golden Gate Bridge. There's been more suicide off the Golden Gate Bridge than, you know, any place in the United States. Seems like when people want to commit suicide, they go to the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. It's interesting. You think if you wanted to kill yourself, you'd really wouldn't care where you did it. But the Golden Gate Bridge is the place of choice. So now they're since I left there, now they're putting a huge barrier up so people can't can't climb over the Golden Gate Bridge anymore. Nothing remains behind. There's not anything we must remember. Just inscribing this practice in our lives. Just inscribing through practicing flow, but not worrying about flow very much. Just taking care of our activities. Just being with them gently, without comparing too much ourselves to someone else. Seeing doubt when it comes in, letting it be there. And I will cheer you on. That's what I want to do, is cheer you on. That's really all I want to do. I would have stayed in the Caribbean. I didn't want to cheer you on. I like the Caribbean. But what I want to do is cheer you on. I have complete confidence in your ability to just inscribe heart-mind within yourselves. I am just a foolish person with not much willpower and not very good at a lot of things. But I know about this. I know about this one thing. And I can help you. I can cheer you on. That's what I want to do. So, do we have questions or comments?
Could you speak to reading behind control and traits of flow?
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, control is an interesting one that they put in there. A sense of control, I'll go over these again, the seven. Challenging. Requires skill, that's challenging, first one. Second is clear goal. Third is sense of control. Fourth is concentration. And then we get into, you don't get into the good stuff till you go through all these others first, right? Deep effortless involvement. Sense of self vanishes. Time stops. We need a sense of control. I have to have a sense of control to keep my Zen practice going. Even after all these years, I don't need a sense of control to come here and sit in the morning because I have a social obligation to be here. But if I had no social obligation to be here, I would need a sense of control to get my butt up, face the wall every morning, even after all these years. We need a sense of control. I need a sense of control. Sometimes, even all these years of sitting, to bring my mind back, I need to say to myself, Tim, right here. Tim, right here. Or something. I need to control, because the mind is incredibly fickle. So that sense of control is important. But that sense of control, ultimately, is so we can move into effortlessness. And this happens to all of us sometimes in activities that we do, but the sense of control first is pretty important. Pretty important. Does that make sense? Do you want to go into that more?
Well, I think I understand it as resolve. You
know? Yeah.
And I think the whole thing of surrender and control is confusing me.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. You could say, of course, we say resolve. That's the second step on the path, is resolve. The first resolve is understanding. The second is resolve. Understanding leads to resolve. But there also has to be controlled resolve. Because we can have resolve. I can have resolve to not blow up at you when you, I don't know what you're going to do that's going to make me mad. But then I actually have to control my emotion when it comes up. If it's out of place, if I'm just reacting instead of responding. This is call and response takes a while. And we notice the reactive mind, we have to control. And not control by repressing, but just notice it and let it soften. Before we act sometimes, so that it can be a genuine response rather than a reaction. anything else this morning?
I appreciated your analogy of grandson falling head up and everybody cheering when he gets up. And I'm looking at the last line here, that there's nothing we must remember. And I was thinking, throughout life, the times when I've fallen, I don't really remember that very well. But I have very fond reflections of the process of getting up again. And that's the thing that, at least with me, would stick.
Well, good.
The process of falling, I think we're too caught up on the fact that we're falling. All the stuff is moving. The process of getting up, that's maybe the tenth breath, and then sort of realize. All right, and then we can be mindful and controlled, but when we're falling, we're too busy falling.
And of course, it's falling is inevitable, and ultimately, another use of the word falling is that we fall into flow. You can't create flow; you fall into it, and then as soon as you want it back, that's not real flow. That's cultivated flow. Real flow, like I say, is an algebraic sign. It's no flow. It's just life, just death, just this, just not this. Challenge. Well, the problem with challenge is that we usually get challenges we don't want. That's the problem. Is the challenges that we want are pretty good. We can get pretty juiced up for the challenges we want. But the challenges we don't want, those are the hardest challenges. Those are the challenges that makes us want to sort of give up on believing that we can ever inscribe anything in ourselves. So those can be very discouraging. And we can become very, very doubtful, very unsure when we get the challenges we don't want. So we can all think of challenges we don't want. And those challenges we don't want, of course, seem like the suffering is overwhelming sometimes. Seems like there is no possibility of sukha within the dukkha. No possibility of deep joy within that suffering. And we just have to come back with kindness to our situation. Our situation is our situation. It's the situation of the whole world, really. And if we can come back with kindness and with openness to it, and if we can't, then we've got it anyway. So even if we can't come back with kindness, it's here. And the challenge is really the opportunity for inscription. Inscription of heart-mind. Because if consciously I tattoo myself with heart-mind, it doesn't really penetrate my heart. It's something I feel good about, but doesn't really penetrate. It only penetrates when I get a challenge I don't want. And I really do my best to take care of that. To be mindful of all the ramifications. How it's affecting me, how it's affecting my friends. Try to be kind, try to be generous, try to maybe have a few wise actions. Even though I screwed up in the last action, there's the possibility for a wise action right now. What do you think? What do you think, Jen?
I like what you said.
Okay. Anything else this morning? Yeah.
I'm just kind of wondering, difficulty, emotional difficulty that we have sometimes on retreats, and I'm struck by it with your comment, with the idea of inscription partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking how remarkable it is, the idea, how remarkable it is of doing that. But how easy it is for us to understand some of the negative things that, instead of thinking of some of our negative baggage that we have that we don't need, that we have had some of those things inscribed. And I'm very familiar with that. And retreats have been sometimes incredibly difficult for me.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. And you've discovered that through your own experience too, haven't you?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I like that. And that happens, of course. Any of us who study psychology know about early childhood experiences. You only have to take one course in psychology to know about that, and later childhood, how there is kind of inscription. And I would just use a little bit of a different metaphor from you, that's all. I wouldn't say surgically remove it. Because I don't think it can be done, frankly. And I think you may end up killing the patient. So instead of surgically removing, I believe that if you're aware of that negative stuff when it comes up, and you see how predominant it is, and you don't indulge it, and you don't repress it, and you're just there with it, that it begins actually to lose its inscriptive power. And that you go to a deeper place. The inscription still might be there in your skin, but actually, at the center, your center, it's not there. It's not there at your very center.
It's you erase the narrative that goes with the...
Pardon?
You erase the narrative that goes with the event.
Well, in a way, yeah. Edwin?
I was just wondering, how about alternatively letting it unwind?
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, I think that's good. What happens partly is that we have wounds from the past, and we stitch up those wounds before too early sometimes because they're so painful. So we're all to survive. We're stitching up our wounds all the time, and we're stitching them up without giving them enough air, without giving them enough sunlight to heal. And so we're walking around like Frankenstein with all these stitched parts from our childhood, from our past. And we stitch, and when we sit in retreat, we sit in sesshin, we begin to feel that stuff. We begin to feel where the pain underneath those stitches. And if we're really mindful, if we're really gentle, we can begin to let those stitches sort of disintegrate. Not too fast. I wouldn't surgically remove myself, but the right idea.
But it does feel like what you're saying fits for me, the sense of going underneath and just assuming that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
There is more healing.
Yeah. And the thing about retreats is that you never know. You can go for years and not have this kind of thing happen. Or all of a sudden, it can be happening all day in a retreat. There's no pattern. There's no pattern. Yeah.
I was just going to build on what Judy was saying, that, you know, you were talking, Judy, about feeling all these feelings during these retreats, and I've been there, you know, experiencing the same kind of stuff, but, you know, what's really interesting from my perspective is you know, the first pass is acknowledging it, sitting on the cushion, really feeling it. It's hard to make it go away. You know, there's no distractions. And then you go through Gyokusan with Tim. And that's like the second half for me, is then I verbalize it. And then maybe tears flow or whatever, but that's, you were talking about that loosening, and then after talking about it with somebody, it just kind of dissipates much. If I didn't talk about it, I'd be, I think, still kind of repressing.
Mm.
But by acknowledging it to somebody else, it's less repressive,
Makes sense. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you.